Point of order. Messages from the House.
January the 17th, 2013. Third reading passed from the House of Representatives. Mr. President, the bills listed below pass the House on third reading by the vote indicated. House Bill number 17, School Capital Construction Enrollment Methodology. Ayes 58, excused 2. House Bill number 24, Probate Amendments. Ayes 58, excused 2. House Bill number 43, Failure to Extinguish or Contain a Fire. Ayes 58, excused 2. House Bill number 51, Probate Objections to Appointment. Ayes 58, excused 2. And House Bill 79, Collection of Unpaid Wages. Ayes 45, noes 14, excused 1. Patricia Benskin, House Chief Clerk.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. President. May I please have privilege of the floor?
You may.
Okay, thank you. Stand up, Julia. I know you all remember last year when I introduced our Rotary Exchange student from Mexico. And this year I would like to introduce our Rotary Exchange student from Germany. Julia Kisserher? Okay, I'll let you say it.
You're at East, right? East?
Okay. She's currently a senior at East, which is very interesting because when she goes back to Munich, she has to repeat her junior and senior year at Gymnasium, their high school, before she can graduate and go on to college. Her decisions in the future, she'll attend a EU university somewhere because they can go anywhere they want. She's looking at Sweden right now, but she's thoroughly enjoying her time in Cheyenne, and we in Rotary are very much enjoying her. So if you'll please welcome her to the Senate.
Welcome to the Senate. Further messages from the House.
January the 17th, 2013, from the House of Representatives. Third reading passed, amended. Mr. President, the bills listed below passed the House on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. House Bill number 2, Election Code Revisions. Ayes 57, noes 1, excused 2. House Bill number 9, Election Code Revisions 2. Ayes 58, excused 2. House Bill number 8, Child Abuse Reporting Requirements. Ayes 46, noes 13, excused 1. House Bill 41, Wild Bison Licenses. Ayes 59, excused 1. House Bill number 52, Workplace Safety Initiatives. Ayes 59, excused 1. And House Joint Resolution 1, Mandatory Judicial Retirement. Ayes 47, noes 12, excused 1. Patricia Benskin, House Chief Clerk.
Introduction, reading, and reference of bills. Senate File 138, first reading of the bill.
Senate File 138, Commutation of Sentences, sponsored by Senator Burns, an act relating to sentencing.
Senate File 138 is referred to Committee Number 1, Judiciary. Senate File 137, first reading of the Senate file.
Senate File 137, Protection of Animals, sponsored by Senator Burns, an act relating to protection of animals.
Senate File 137 is referred to Committee Number 5, Agriculture. Senate File 136, first reading of the Senate file.
Senate File 136, Seismic Exploration 3, sponsored by Senator Burns, an act relating to oil and gas.
Senate File 136 is referred to Committee Number 9, Minerals. Senate File 135, first reading of the Senate file.
Senate File 135, Assisted Living Facilities Regulation, sponsored by Senator Scott, an act relating to regulation of health care facilities.
Senate File 135 is referred to Committee Number 10, Labor. Reports from standing committees.
January the 17th, 2013, Mr. President, your committee number 2, Appropriations, to whom was referred Senate File 76, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. I, Senators Bebout, Dockstader, Hastert, Meyer, and Perkins, Senator Perkins, Chairman. January the 17th, 2013, Mr. President, your committee number 2, Appropriations, to whom was referred Senate File 60, Medicaid Reform, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. I, Senators Bebout, Dockstader, Hastert, and Meyer, and Perkins, Senator Bebout, Chairman. January the 17th, 2013, Mr. President, your committee number 7, Corporation Elections and Political Subdivisions, to whom was referred Senate File 19, Hospital District Elections, reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. I, Senators Case, Hines, Johnson, Nutting, and Scott, Senator Case, Chairman. January the 17th, 2013. Mr. President, your committee number 7, Corporation Election Political Subdivision, to whom was referred Senate File 6, Office of Consumer Advocate Revisions, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. I, Senators Case, Hines, Johnson, Nutting, and Scott, Senator Hines, Chairman. January the 16th, 2013, Mr. President, your committee number 2, Appropriations, to whom was referred Senate File 105, School Capital Construction, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass amended. I, Senators Bebout, Dockstader, Hastert, and Perkins, excuse Senator Meyer, Senator Bebout, Chairman.
Senator Nicholas, we're at that order of business, consideration of bills on general file.
Mr. President, I'd move that we return and resolve back into committee of the whole.
Heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Senator Johnson.
Committee of the Whole will come to order. Our next file for our consideration is Senate File 66. The reading clerk will please read it.
Senate File 66, State-Funded Conservation Easements Restrictions, sponsored by the Select Natural Resource Funding Committee, an act relating to state-funded conservation easements. It was referred to Committee Number 5, Agriculture, State, Public Lands, and Water Resources. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. I, Senators Driscoll, Emmerich, Geis, Hicks, and Johnson, Senator Geis, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure?
come on. Go on.
Senator Geis.
Mr. Chairman, when the Committee of the Whole rise and report, I move that Senate File 66 do pass. I'd like to have the Standing Committee Amendment read in.
Senate File 66, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, page 2, line 5.
Mr. Chairman, I would...
Senator Geis.
Mr. Chairman, I would move the Standing Committee Number 1 to Senate File 66 and yield the floor to Senator Hicks to explain the bill and the amendment.
Senator Hicks.
Mr. Chairman and members of the body, on the bill, let me give you a little background on this, the genesis of this particular bill. This was at the direction of Management Council last year. If you recollect, there was quite a bit of discussion on the floor here about the use of state funds for some of these conservation easements. And as a result of that, Management Council directed the Select Natural Resource Funding Committee to conduct a couple of days of public hearings associated with the use of state funds on these and try to address some of these issues that were outlined out there, such things as do they have an effect on the mineral estate and other outstanding issues that people might have that they wanted to bring up. We did have 2 days of public testimony in August and Lander on this subject of the use of state funds and some of the issues that were brought up. As a result of those 2 days of hearings, this was bill as a genesis of that. It basically came out of there that there was agreement across the board within the committee, and I think broad consensus within the public that this is something that they wanted to see included, associated with the state utilizing some funding for these conservation easements. Let me walk you through the bill and talk about what those are. I would like to point out before we go there that these are primarily policies and practices that the Trust Fund Board has already implemented. But there was a lot of feeling from the public when we took public testimony that they wanted these basically codified in statutes to make sure that everybody knows what the legislative intent was associated with these funds. So, again, the Trust Fund Board has already been adhering to these principles and policy and the use of the funds and the easements that have already been funded. But I'd like to walk through the bill right now, and if you'll just flip over to page number 2, and then the first section in, basically what this section was targeted to do is make sure that the state of Wyoming's interest and the average interest that the state has in these conservation easements today is about 10% of the total cost. So for the most part, the state's on the hook for about 10% of whatever that total cost of that easement was. But the intent here with this language is to make sure that if the easement is either sold, transferred, or extinguished, that the state would be able to recoup the value on a prorated basis that they put into that easement to begin with. So it protects the state's third-party interest in those easements where those funds were expended. If we go down to the next section, Section O, it's a prohibition. In other words, anybody that wanted to include in this prohibition, what this prohibition basically says is you can't have as the terms and conditions of a conservation easement that prescribe management actions. That is an inappropriate use of a conservation easement. That easement is to purchase the development rights. It's not to prescribe management of how that land will be managed for livestock or crops. So it would prohibit the use of state funds for any easements that had prescriptive management actions associated to how you were going to run your agricultural operation. If we go to Section P, there's a conclusion in there. If you go back to the enabling language of these, one of the provisions in the enabling language is to maintain open space in agriculture. They wanted this codified again in statute to make sure that we would never fund an easement through the state of Wyoming that would prohibit ranching and farming activities. If you flip over to the next page, Q says no funds will be distributed under this act for the purchase of an easement which prohibit hunting. Now, I need to make a distinguishment here because there is some confusion with this. This prohibition is to say the state of Wyoming will not contribute funds to an easement that in perpetuity would prohibit hunting. Because there is a couple, there's one national organization out there whose stated goal is to eliminate hunting. I'm not aware of there maybe one or two, one small parcel of land in the state of Wyoming, but that's their intent, is to basically acquire land and prohibit hunting. This just says the state of Wyoming is not going to invest in any conservation easements that would prohibit hunting. It does not prohibit you as an easement holder or you as a landowner, because they are only purchasing the development rights. You still retain the right to prohibit hunting around your buildings or on your property. By no way, form, or fashion does this convey a public access or a public easement for that purpose. So I hope that clarifies that. With that, Mr. Chairman, what I would like to do, I believe the amendment has been moved. If I could speak to the amendment.
Please do.
This bill was generated at our December meeting that we had in Casper. Again, we took public testimony on the bill, and that was December 18th. Since that time, we've had the luxury of having a very reputable attorney here in Cheyenne that has done a lot of conservation easements review the bill for us, and it came back with some suggested language to really tighten up and clarify what we're trying to do in the first section on that as far as protecting the state's third-party interest. So if you go through that language on page 2, line 5, it just says solely with the contingency. So what that basically does is just identify the right to enforce the terms of that easement. It's solely, and then if you read the rest of that sentence, basically it says enforce the terms and conditions. The way the language was before, it would have allowed the state to jump in there real quick, probably prematurely in the case that one of these easements was being transferred. That was the concern. What this basically does is said, if the grantee fails to enforce the terms and condition of the easement, and that's when the state would step in. If it was just a transfer and the terms and the condition of the easement were still in place, and was just transferred to a different easement holder, then the state wouldn't be involved in that component of it. If we go down through the next section and we get to the page 2, line 7, still deals with that same issue of trying to protect the state's third-party interest in that. Then if we move down to page 2, line 8, here's the component. What we did in there is we add for value. In other words, if an easement was being transferred, and that easement was transferred, and there wasn't any net gain in the price of the easement, then there's no value there for the state to go after. This would mean as if an easement was sold, transferred, or extinguished, and there was a monetary gain by the entity that was now taken recipient of this easement, that the state could, through that third-party vested interest in that, if that was extinguished, to go after that third-party component for that value in that easement. And that's where you get down to page 2, line 10 and 11. It just talks about recover from the proceeds of the transfer for the value, and that's the key word there, is for the value, sale, extinguishment of the state's prorated share of the proceeds based on the funds the state provided initially for the creation of that easement. With that, Mr. Chairman, I would ask for your favorable consideration of Standing Committee Amendment Number 1. And I'd stand for any questions.
Questions? Senator Bernard. Yes, we
are
on
the amendment. Mr. Senator Hicks.
Aren't we?
On line, on page 3, line 2, talks about the purchase of easements which prohibit hunting. What about fishing?
Yes. Senator Barnard, we're on the amendment.
We're on the amendment? Oh,
yes.
Sorry.
Okay. If there are no more questions, all those in favor of Senator Geis's motion to adopt Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 66, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The Senate Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 66 is passed. We are back on the bill. Senator Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. President. Three questions. One, I join with our colleague who just asked the question of why was hunting selected out in fishing. We see a lot of easements that are restrict public access to hunting and fishing. And I noticed that in this instance, you're prohibiting hunting and fishing, but there's nothing that would restrict your capacity to restrict access. So you can't have access to it. Of course, if you can hunt and fish there if you're a friend or you're a ranch manager. And what we're seeing on some of the ranches that is that there's an actual restriction for access, so there's no public access to hunt or fish, which is different than whether or not you can hunt or fish if you could get access. I also noticed that so that's one. Two, and a lot of this language came out of budgetary restrictions that we put in, and I think it's great that you're putting this into statute, but on lines, in most instances you have no funds will be dispersed, but over on page three, you say no funds shall be distributed, so you abandoned the word dispersed and went to distributed, which has a different legal significance. I'm curious whether that was just inadvertent or inadvertent. Finally, the third thing is you've used the word prohibit so that you won't prohibit hunting or fishing or prohibit the use of livestock. And I think in earlier budget language, we had restrict, limit, or anyway prohibit, or anyway limit. So in this instance, I take it you'd be okay if you created the easement. You said, well, you can have up to one animal unit on the ranch, or so you can, unless you're prohibiting it entirely, then the lease is okay. But I'm curious why you didn't use, I think there was prior language, that whether you restrict, limit, or prohibit any type of these things. So we're saying, at least for wildlife, for cattle, and for fishing, that there has to be no limitations on the use at all.
Senator Rothfuss.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I'm also curious about OP and Q overall. I see a clear need for N and a clear justification for having that in statute, but I'm wondering on little OP and Q, why is this coming up? Are there cases in the past where this was a problem? If so, how many of each of these things have come up where we've had easements that conflicted with this? Are there any on the horizon that we're worried about and we need the statutory language in place to protect us from some type of concern? Or are these just things that, honestly, when we were drafting the bill and we came up with N, we thought, hey, here's a couple more good ideas, too. I'm just not seeing a need for this additional legislation, and I'd like some further explanation for what's motivating that change in statute.
Senator Landon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to piggyback off my friends' comments, OP, Q, I also have some questions on that. I just wonder if we really want to codify, if a family wants to provide us with one of these easements, for example, in O, and they want to mandate that there is always a cattle ranch there. I just have that question. Or if you go down to P, we'll never prohibit ranching, farming. What if a family is not currently ranching and farming, but they want to give us that easement? I'm just wondering if we really want to box ourselves into corners like that and not have any flexibility.
Senator Christensen.
Mr. Chairman, just to further pile on, I don't know if that was, there was a brash young senator one time that really thought hunting, fishing, and trapping were important, and changed our Constitution. I think some of the questions that have been raised are good questions, but when we talk about the access of using public dollars, I think that it helps support those areas of OP and Q, and I appreciate the intent of, you know, if we're going to use public dollars, the public has some protection.
Further discussion or questions? Who gets to answer this? Senator Hicks.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I'm glad you threw the flag. No more piling on. I appreciate that. Let me try to work some of these in reverse order, and specifically because there seems to be a great concern with OP and Q. And the answer to the first question is there has been a couple of cases where these came up. And let me first talk to the issue of where it talks about specific practices. Again, keep in mind the intent of what a conservation easement is supposed to do is when you acquire one of those, what you're actually acquiring is the development rights, and that's what you're purchasing. Now, what happened is there was an easement that wasn't transacted with state funds, but this has happened on several occasions that says you have to have 6 inches of stubble height, and you can't spray this herbicide, and you can't use this type of stuff and that type of stuff. That's really outside the bounds of what an easement is supposed to do. So what we want to do is, if you can do that as a landowner, if you want to sell your easement to somebody, organization that's going to tell you how to manage your land and manage your operation, then you can do that. Only thing this bill says is if you're using state funds, we're not going to allow the terms and conditions of those easements to prescribe to the landowner how you're going to manage your cattle or how you're going to manage your crops, what herbicides you can do, what time of day you have to, how much stubble height and all that stuff. So I hope that clears that up. But there has been easements here in Wyoming that prescribed how you're going to manage it and how much material you had to leave and couldn't graze, more of a prescriptive easement than a conservation easement. So that's O. Let's move on down to Q. No funds shall be dispersed under this act. Again, it's the same intent. And if we look at the purchase on almost every one of these easements, is to maintain farming and ranching. And the testimony that we had is that we didn't hear one opposition to this. And they said, look, if you're going to use state funds, and one of the intents of this program is to maintain open space and agriculture, is put it in the statutes and say, if you want to do an easement and eliminate agriculture from that landscape, it just says that the state's not going to invest in it. And that's been the policy of the board all along. So it doesn't say that if you want to sell an easement to some other organization and say you can never have agriculture on the landscape, you can do that. It just says if you're going to use state funds, that we feel it's an important enough here in Wyoming that you never and here's the deal. It's just like the hunting one that we'll talk about next. Doesn't say you have to. It just says you can't burn it. You can't in perpetuity. Remember the word perpetuity. When you do these easements, it's in perpetuity. And all it says here is if you want the state to invest money in this conservation easement, you can't in perpetuity take the use of agriculture off that landscape. It doesn't say that you can't do it as your own choice. We'll invest in those, and you can put an easement on, and if my good friend from Corona County only wants to run one AUM on his ranch for the next 100 years, he can do that. It just says you can't put it as a term and condition of the easement that you're going to eliminate agriculture. So let's get to the next one. And I thank you for the reminder from my good friend from Teton County that we probably should have fishing and trapping on there also. Again, this was a big item of discussion because there is a national organization that does go out and try to acquire easement with the explicit purpose of banning hunting. So if you know, we could bring that back as a second reading amendment to include fishing and trapping, but the people that showed up at committee felt pretty compelled that we would never, ever, as a state, invest in an easement. Again, it doesn't preclude you to being able to do that. It just says you can't use state money that in perpetuity would say you're never going to hunt on this piece of property. The point on fishing and trapping is well taken. Let me see if I covered all of them. There was one other one on here. Oh, the language on Q as far as distribute versus disperse, I think we can fix that in a second meeting amendment. And then, let's see, there was some other language or some other questions, and quite frankly, I can't remember exactly what they were. So the good senator would all, McGinn County, would refresh my memory. I might be able to answer that question.
Senator Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I want to make clear that, I'd like to have some more clarity. When we talk about no state funds being used, my understanding is all we're talking about here is the Wildlife National Trust Fund and what the trust fund can be used for. As I'm looking at the statute, this applies only to the Wildlife Natural Resources Trust Fund. It would not govern what other state funds could do. So we're just talking about the Wildlife Trust Fund. And when we began that, we first started out, my recollection, folks can help me, my recollection, we said we won't acquire any easements. That wasn't the purpose, is to acquire easements. Rather, it was to go out and do habitat restoration. And our intent was not to take more of the land of the state and tie it up into perpetuity. So the idea is we wouldn't do it at all. Then we stretched the rules a little bit to say, okay, maybe there are some easements out there that would really have a great benefit. But we said only under some certain limitations. And in this instance, I concur, and I think you've done the right thing by saying in those limited areas where we are going to authorize acquisition of easements, we'll do those in certain areas, but my recollection is that we were generally prohibiting acquisition of easements except where we authorized it specifically in the budget, but I don't remember. And I guess I'd like to have a refresher with respect, somebody that remembers with what we did with respect of when do we get in the acquisition of easements using the trust fund, essentially, to go out and tie up land in Wyoming when we have already such a large portion of our state tied up in federal lands that can never be developed. And is that the intent of the Wildlife Trust Fund? And that is to go buy up and secure more land. But if we are going to do it, I think we ought to make it clear what its purposes are. And I think if you're going to say hunting, fishing, and ag, all that has to be unrestricted, we say that. It's not that hard to do that. And so you have to fundamentally decide when are we going to get in the business of using our trust fund for land acquisition or for easement acquisition.
Senator Hicks.
Mr. Chairman, members of the body, unfortunately, I'm a little disadvantaged to those discussions because they all occurred prior to my presence in this body. But what I would tell you that I will go back and find out, I have never seen the restrictions that says that those funds could not be used for conservation easements, but I will have that answer for the good senator from Albany County on the second reading.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, I have a question in another area. Looking at subsection N on page 2, lines 1 through 11, and the Standing Committee Amendment has changed things around somewhere, and it may be I don't understand what they've done. But my concern is where somebody gets one of these easements and the terms of it aren't getting enforced, and they do something that violates the easement, and there's a financial recovery provision here. My concern is, do we have the ability to, instead of deciding we want financial recovery, do we have the ability to go back and enforce the terms of the easement, take a legal action to enforce it? And let me give you, Mr. Chairman, a potential hypothetical that may focus what I'm thinking about. Suppose we go out and get an easement to prevent development of some key winter ranges, some species we're very interested in, say, take mountain sheep, because sheep licenses are so popular and so hard to get. And it's not necessarily that we want hunting on the easement land, but we need to have their winter habitat protected so there'll be sheep so they can be hunted on other lands in the hunting season. And somebody decides, gee, that's prime real estate. And yeah, there's an easement there, but we'd make a lot more money if we subdivided it. And they file for a subdivision. And I think under those circumstances, the state might well feel, we're not interested in the money can be made. We're interested in the bighorn sheep and their winter range. And we've put our share up to make sure that winter range was protected. And we want to sue for specific performance of the easement and then enforce that restriction. Do we have under this the ability to do that, or do we just have ability to recover the ill-gotten gains, or our share of the ill-gotten gains? That's my question and my concern in this particular area.
Senator Hicks.
Mr. Chairman, the way I read this is exactly as the good senator from Natrona County. If the easement holder fails to enforce the terms of those conditions of that easement, the only recourse the state of Wyoming has is not to enforce the terms and conditions. Our recourse is to get the money back that we invested in there on a prorated basis. That's the way I read the bill.
Senator Scott.
That was the way I read the bill, and I was afraid I might be right, because that's not what we ought.
That's not where we ought to be.
Mr. Chairman, I think, and unless some member of the committee can persuade me I'm wrong, or somebody else can, I think we ought to say, look, we have an option to recover the ill-gotten gains, because that may be the sensible thing to do in some cases. Or we have an option to go to court and enforce the specific terms of the easement. And my question at this point, Mr. Chairman, is why wouldn't that be an appropriate second reading amendment?
Seeing nobody stand up, is there anybody else who wishes to question or comment? Okay, question being called for. All those in favor of Senator Geis's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, that it do so with a favorable recommendation of Senate File 66, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Senate File 66 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next file for our consideration is Senate File 34. The reading clerk will please read it.
Senate File 34, Law Enforcement Academy Director Duties, sponsored by Senator Anderson, 02, an act relating to the Wyoming Law Enforcement Academy. It was referred to Committee Number 1 Judiciary. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Burns, Christensen, Escobel, Hicks, and Schiffer. Senator Schiffer, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Senator Schiffer?
Mr. Chairman, move with the Committee of the Whole rise to report it do so with a favorable recommendation on Senate File 34, Law Enforcement Academy Director Duties. Mr. Chairman, there is a standing committee amendment, and I would ask that it be read in at this time.
Senate File 34, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, page 2, line 19.
Mr. Chairman, I would move the Standing Committee Amendment, and for a discussion of this great bill, I would yield the floor to Senator Anderson.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, in regard to Senate File 34, I will just simply say that this act relates to the Wyoming Law Enforcement Academy, specifying the duties of the director of the Law Enforcement Academy and providing for an effective date. I bring this bill at the request of the Attorney General and the Director of the Academy, which is located in Douglas. It's born out of a need for, I think, more clarity and more authority to be given to the Director in order to, I think, fulfill his duties and the responsibilities that he has as Director. A little bit of brief background, and I'll do this pretty rapidly, so if any members of the committee want to fill in kind of some of the blanks, but I'll just simply say, you know, Wyoming for years back had a rather loose-knit law enforcement community. We had local police officers within towns and communities. Many little towns had a marshal, and then, of course, we had county sheriffs and others. And as we progressed through time, there became a need for, I think, more cross-training and more, perhaps, contemporary, sophisticated kind of training. So they started thinking about bringing a set of standards and whatnot. And so it's this whole idea of a law enforcement academy has evolved, and it started with an expert in training law enforcement tactics and techniques in Laramie, and then later that was moved then to Douglas to the state fairgrounds. And then in about the 1970s, they started I'm sure that there's some historical memory here, because there's a bit of a story attached to that. But anyway, they built an academy in Douglas, which still exists today, and they hired a director. Well, in doing that, some things I think were overlooked. So with that, I'm going to start into the bill, and I'll talk a little bit about the bill. And Mr. Chairman, I'll just deal with the amendment. It's a simple amendment as I get to that point in the bill. But anyway, if we look in the bill, lines 7 through 16 on page 1, this has to do with section Wyoming Statute 9163A, and it's amended. Now, I'm going to take just a minute to look at some of the existing language that appears here. That language starts on line 14 through 16 on page 1 and continues on through line 5, page 2. The reason I talk about that bit of language that's in existing law primarily is the extent of those duties or those responsibilities are spelled out for the director at this time. It says simply that he is appointed by the Attorney General with consent of the governor. He will serve at the pleasure, of course, of the Attorney General. He shall have administrative and operational experience in criminal justice and such other qualifications to satisfy the Attorney General. And that's about it. That's all that's really in there today. Well, that went along with that oversight. And then in the summer of 2009, the Wyoming Law Enforcement Academy, of course, had an increase in basic students' after-hours activities. And there were a group of academy students that went downtown in a local establishment and started practicing some of their skills. Well, as it turned out then, a subcommittee was created to review the issues and provide the association with a recommendation of what can be done. Well, the Law Academy, along with the Post people and some others, a group dealing with sheriffs and other, sat down and drew up some rules. And it was asked, the question was raised as they drew up these rules, whether or not they had the authority to establish a code of conduct. Well, that question then was given to the Attorney General, and he reviewed it and said under those conditions, the director did not have that authority. And so that's kind of what brought us to this point. So in order, Mr. Chairman, and I'll move on into the bill and not be too verbose about it, but anyway, what you see then, the new language starting then on page 7, page 2 starts then giving that necessary authority. And this is what we then, through this bit of legislation, gives then to the duties of the director. Gives him the ability as 7 through 8, supervise and direct all the activities of the Law Academy. It also, line 10 through 12, enables him to establish policies and procedures to promote for a safe, healthy, and productive training environment. And then the third section, line 14 through 17 says that he will be given then the ability to promulgate rules and regulations to ensure the maintenance of a productive learning environment, which may include a code of conduct and the disciplinary rules for students. Then we come then to line 19, and Mr. Chairman, that's where the amendment is inserted. So at this time, the amendment having been moved, I would like to deal with the amendment. The amendment then refers to page 2, line 19, and this was, of course, done at careful observation of the Standing Committee. It says, after the word established, we should insert curriculum and. So that would enable them to establish curriculum and standards for the satisfactory completion and so on. So with that, Mr. Chairman, having moved that already, I would call for the question on the amendment.
Okay, question being called. All those in favor of Senator Schiffer's motion to adopt Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 34, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The amendment has passed. We're back on the bill. Senator Anderson.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, of course, that does bring us back on the bill. There's little else that I would take time at this to explain. I think it's pretty self-explanatory in those four sections we just talked about. I would then pause for any questions, or certainly I would defer to any members of the committee that might feel that I missed something. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Are there any questions, any comments? Question having been called. All those in favor of Senator Schiffer's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, that it do so with a favorable recommendation on Senate File 34, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Senate File 34 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 62. The reading clerk will please read the bill.
Senate File 62, State Board of Education Membership, sponsored by Senator Cole, an act relating to the State Board of Education.
You've heard the reading an amendment.
It was referred to Committee Number 4, Education, reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Anderson, 02, Senators Barnard, Cole, Landon, and Ruffa, Senator Cole, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Senator Coe?
Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rise and report, it do so with a do pass recommendation on Senate File 62. There's no amendments on this bill. I would briefly tell you that what this bill does, it goes, we have two members at large on the State Board of Education. It goes in and takes one of those and replaces it with a member of a school district board of trustees at the time of appointment. That's all the bill does. I thought it might be a good idea to, because we've had some discussions on the state board, maybe just to talk about the structure of the state board for the benefit of the education discussions we've had here recently. The State Board of Education is composed of 12 voting members, 11 of whom shall be appointed. By the way, this is Article 3, Statute 212301. Be appointed members with at least one member appointed from each appointment district. The remaining voting member of the board shall be the State Superintendent of Public Instruction. One appointed member shall be appointed at large and shall be a certified classroom teacher at the time of appointment. One appointed member shall also be appointed at large and shall be a certified school administrator at the time of appointment. Two appointed members shall be appointed at large and shall be representative of private business or industry in Wyoming. This is where we take one of those away and give it to somebody on a school board. The remaining seven appointed members of the board shall be appointed from among the lay citizens of the state who are electors of the state. Then six appointed members of the board shall be from one... Seven appointed members of the board shall be appointed from among the lay citizens of the state who are electors of the state known for their public spirit. I like that. Business or professional ability and interest in education. Not more than six appointed members of the board shall be from one political party. That brings you up to date on the structure of the state board. What this does is something that the School Boards Association has asked for about 3 years, and with the ongoing dialogue we're having right now with the state board and the added duties that we put on that state board, I think it's appropriate for this change. Ask for your support of the bill.
Questions on the bill? Senator Case.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm trying to understand this. So there's a 12-member board, and right now, not in this bill, there's this issue about party makeup being no more than six. Would that be correct? And this bill doesn't change the party makeup. This bill just goes in and takes two members previously designated as business become at large, and one. So it increases flexibility. Why don't we increase flexibility about the party makeup as well? Because six and six is kind of hard. The Wyoming political landscape isn't exactly 50-50. Could we give it more flexibility and say something like no more than four or something like that?
Senator Coe.
Well, to the good senator, Mr. Chairman, to the good senator from Fremont County, you know, if you want to bring an amendment, we can talk about it. But I can tell you that the numbers on the state board don't change with this change here I'm making. We just replace one at-large member with a member from a state school board, district board. And so nothing changes with the overall numbers. Nothing changes with the overall numbers. If you want to bring an amendment and talk about the structure of the state board, that'd be okay because it's a focal point of education accountability right now.
Senator Case.
Mr. Chairman, just to be clear, I'm not trying to change the number on the board. I'm just thinking out loud of a possible amendment because, you know, it might be hard to find six of one particular party to serve on the board. And that's basically saying it's half and half. I don't think any other boards exactly go half and half. And it's not representative of the mix in the state. I don't think it should be, frankly, Mr. Chairman, but I wonder if we should allow more flexibility. It's an opportunity to do that.
Senator Rothfuss.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, just to clarify, there are more than six of us.
There are more than six.
Mr. Chairman, I didn't mean to say why.
Further discussion. I don't see anybody standing up. Thank you. Thank you. All those in favor of Senator Coe's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation for Senate 5, File 62, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Senate File 62 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next Senate file for our consideration is Senate File 82. The reading clerk will please read the bill.
Senate File 82, Game Bird Farm Licenses Expiration, sponsored by Senator Ross, and Act relating to Game Bird Farms. It was referred to Committee Number 6, Travel, Recreation, Wildlife, Cultural Resources. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Barnard, Burns, Christensen, Kraft, and Driscoll. Senator Burns, Chairman.
Heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Senator Burns?
Mr. Chairman, we're on 82, correct?
Affirmative.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with a favorable recommendation on Senate File 82, Game Bird Licenses Expiration. There are no standing committee amendments, and for a further explanation of the bill, I ask that you call on the good president of this body.
Mr. President.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Bring to you Senate File 82, Game Bird Farm Licensing Expiration. I'll be the first to tell you that I know nothing about game bird farms, but I do know the funky chicken. Just got to have a little humor here. This is a simple bill. I have a constituent that has two game bird farms, and the current way in which the game bird hunting season is from August 31st to March 31st, but the statute requires that you get a new license on February 1, which makes no sense because then you're right in the middle of your season, you got more paperwork and everything else to do, and you got reports that have to go to Game and Fish and vice versa. So everybody's in favor of this. I mean, it just moves the date to the end of the hunting season. And they get to renew their license on April
1. All those in favor of Senator Burns' motion that when the committee of the whole... Did you want to say something, Senator Anderson?
No, he's sitting down.
Okay, back to question. Are those in favor of Senator Burns' motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation of Senate File 82, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Senate File 82 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 84.
Senate File 84, Wyoming Health Insurance Pool Premium, sponsored by Senator Scott, and Act Relating to Insurance. It was referred to Committee Number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Anderson, 28. Senators Kraft, Nutting, Peterson, and Scott. Senator Scott, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure?
Chairman.
Senator Scott.
I move when the Committee of the Whole rise and report that it do so with the recommendation that Senate File 84 do pass. It was a standing committee amendment. I ask it be read in at this time.
Senate File 3.
Mr. Chairman, I move adoption of the standing committee amendment. Mr. Chairman, the standing committee amendment makes two corrections, one of which is really technical and the other of which not of great substance. On page 3, line 3, we replace the word commissioner with the word board. It's the board that actually does things. The commissioner, I believe, is a member of the board, but the board is the correct citation there. And so it does that. And then increases in costs of claims and expenses, as written says, due to medical inflation. We remove that due to medical inflation phrase so it reflects increases in cost of claims and expenses. I urge adoption of the Standing Committee Amendment. Be happy to answer any questions on the Standing Committee Amendment.
Questions? Question having been called. All those in favor of Senator Scott's motion to adopt standing committee amendment number 1 to Senate File 84, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Senate File, standing committee amendment number 1 to Senate File 84 has passed. Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, in explaining the bill, this bill is the first of several measures we're going to see in this session that are dealing with the consequences of the national health care reform and the things it's expected to do. And let me explain what we expect the national health care reform to do in the private insurance market, and that will explain the need for this bill. And this bill I developed in conjunction with the insurance commissioner. We had several get-togethers where we were talking back and forth on what do we see the reform doing in the private health insurance market. And at first, the advice we were getting from the local experts here in Wyoming was we could expect the reform to result in the individual market in an increase of 20 to 40%. in premiums. And then we both went to a meeting of the National Association of Insurance Commissioners back in D.C. and consulted the national experts and consulted experts in other states that regulate rates. And we're told, no, you can expect private insurance rates in the individual market to increase in the range of 40 to 100%. And our conclusion, and there's several reasons for that, and let me just go through some of the principal ones. First, they're requiring guarantee issue in the individual market. Second, they have restricted the age rating to 3 to 1, I think in an effort to gain support from some of the organizations representing elderly folks. Reality is that the range ought to be 6 to 1, with younger people having the much lower premiums. So that requirement will kick up especially the premiums for the young folks. Third, they limit the amount of copayments and deductibles in ways that are considerably below many of the policies sold in our current market. And then there's a whole series of other mandates that I won't go into. Our conclusion was that we can expect, Mr. Chairman, a chaos in the pricing of insurance policies in the individual markets, starting perhaps this coming fall, certainly in 2014, because our conclusion was, with the estimates we were getting from the experts, that they don't know themselves. And I think, Mr. Chairman, the reason they don't know is that it's not clear how individuals are going to respond to the incentives in the national reform that are there that would tend to increase the cost. And, okay, what's the how does that relate to this bill, Mr. Chairman? What this bill does is cut our uninsurable pool loose from the private market for rate-setting purposes. The way it's always been is the rates in the uninsurable pool are a percentage, I think it's currently 150%, if I'm remembering correctly, of the marketplace rate. And rather than see that rate just gyrate as the individual market gyrates, our uninsurable pool is exempt from the things that are going to cause rates to go up in the individual market. So rather than be dependent on the rates in those markets, which it otherwise would be, we say, let's take the rates as that the bill provides and say that they'll stay what they are, that for the period July 1, 2013, which is the effective date, through June 30, 2015, we'll stick with the rates that were in effect on January 1, 2013, what's there right now, and just allow the board to adjust those according to the experience they have. If their costs go up, then they can adjust the rates. So we'll immunize the uninsurable pool from the consequences of the uncertainty and the gyrations that we think you're going to see in the private insurance market, so that the people that are in that pool won't be adversely affected by that set of problems. The reason the 2015 date is picked, June 30th, 2015, the pool sunsets on that date, and depending on how the implementation of the national reform goes, we're going to have to use that sunset date to radically reform that uninsurable pool. Theoretically, if everything works right, some of the need for it will go away, not all of it, but a significant portion of it, and we will have to make some changes, but we don't know what they are and won't know for another year or two. So, Mr. Chairman, that's the bill. That's why it's before us. It's a first step in dealing with the problems that we're expecting to see, I'd be happy to answer any questions on the bill or on the reasons for it.
Discussion? Senator Schiffer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the sponsor, I'm trying to figure out what exactly this is going to do. And initially, it seems to me it will probably push people out of the Wyoming high-risk pool into the federal high-risk pool. My reason being that, one, their coverage is so much broader than ours, and two, because of the incentives that are built in that we do not offer in our high-risk pool, things like the 3-to-1 rating and those types of things. But I'm not sure of that. I want to know what, if we do this, where will people land? In the Wyoming high-risk pool, or will they land in the federal high-risk pool? What's it going to do? I'm uncomfortable if it forces them into the federal program, which I'm not sure is going to be very, I'm sure it'll be successful, but it might not get done what people think it's going to get done.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, it should not have that effect. And the reason is, and it's one of the reasons we declined to participate in the federal high-risk pool. The reason is that under the terms of the national reform, anybody that's in our high-risk pool is ineligible to move to the federal pool until they have been uninsured for 6 months. And these are people that need insurance. They can't afford to go uninsured for 6 months to get in on the federal pool, which may in some ways seem more attractive. But they can't afford that uninsured period for 6 months, and that's just the way the Fed structured their pool. It doesn't do the people that are already in our pool any good because of that provision. And that's one of the reasons that the previous governor decided we didn't want to participate in the federal pool. So we do not expect to have that effect.
Senator Rossless.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, I'm just curious for some clarification from the good senator from Natrona County about how our high-risk pool will interrelate with the exemption for previously existing conditions that comes into practice. How do those two interact?
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, and that is my understanding that's scheduled to go into effect on January 1st of 2014. Theoretically, if the subsidies that the federal government is promising to provide through the exchange are adequate, and that requirement is enforced, as it will be, according to the feds, through the entire insurance market. So if you're over the subsidy level, you're going to get the benefit of that guarantee issue. That, Mr. Chairman, will remove the need for a major part of our uninsurable pool. Now, some caveats there. When you're implementing something this complicated, there's always the chance that some piece of the implementation is going to slip in time frame, either because they don't get some rulemaking done or because some private entity brings a lawsuit and says thus and such wasn't done properly and you get a delay. So we need to keep our uninsurable pool intact against that possibility and make sure that the new system works. And second, that guarantee issue provision being one of the things that's causing the increase in rates, those rates will be something that the population can afford only if the feds come through with the subsidy.
and the way they structured the subsidies, as I understand, and I had trouble getting a straight answer on this one, but as I understand, is that your premium is a fixed, and I think it's going to be somewhere around 3% of some measure, probably adjusted AGI, gross, adjusted gross income, of the individual's income. And then the feds pick up the second dollar. If something goes wrong with those subsidies, and they don't occur because the bond vigilantes stop our ability to print money and sell bonds, or sell bonds, and or because the debt ceiling is not increased as much as will be needed, there's several things can go wrong there. If that doesn't go wrong, and the whole population gets hit with those cost increases, we'll see a vast increase in our uninsured population, whereas I'm expecting this is only going to bring a small increase in our uninsured population. But then we'll have to do something radical. We don't know what's going to happen there. Those are just, there's various scenarios you can construct. Everything from everything's going to work just peachy keen, there's going to be a problem or two that delays things, to it just isn't going to work at all, and nobody knows, and we won't know for a while. So, and there is a population which is still going to need our uninsurable pool. So, Mr. Chairman, there's a lot of uncertainty there. What we're just trying to do is get through that uncertain period, and that's what this bill does.
Senator Nicholas.
Mr. Chairman, if we could, and you may have explained it, I've missed it, but would you explain the fiscal note? And as I understand, my recollection is the cost of this program is credited against insurance fees. Fees go into would otherwise go to the general fund. So if we increase the credits, we reduce the general fund amount. And I'm not quite sure how to interpret the fiscal note and whether or not it says, well, there's no fiscal impact now, but there will be more later. If you might explain that, please.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, let me see if I can explain what I think the fiscal impact is going to be here. We passed the bill. The fiscal impact is going to be very close to what the current fiscal impact is. This bill prevents us from changing the world. In the absence of the bill, you might see a big change in our fiscal impact. You might make the premiums in the uninsurable pool suddenly such that nobody could afford it, and we'll drive everybody out, and we'll get all that premium tax money instead of going up and make the deficit as it does now. It'll come to the state. That would be a possible outcome. The state would have more money. The state would have a great big problem with a bunch of uninsured people. The problem that the pool was designed to fix. And we'd have to do something radical to do something about that. There's a theoretical impact of the bill. In practice, what the bill is doing is preserving the status quo till we see how all this shakes out.
Further questions? Question having been called. All of those in favor of Senator Scott's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation on Senate File 84, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Senate File 84 is passed the Committee of the Whole. The next Senate file for our consideration is Senate File 85. The reading clerk will please read it.
Senate File 85, Game and Fish Residence Preference Points, sponsored by Senator Hicks, and act relating to game and fish. It was referred to Committee Number 6, Travel, Recreation, Wildlife, and Cultural Resources, reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Barnard, Burns, Christensen, Kraft, and Driscoll. Senator Burns, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Senator Burns?
Well, Mr. Chairman, before I get to the bill, could I have privilege of the floor, please?
Most certainly, Senator.
Mr. Chairman, it is my distinct pleasure to welcome to the floor here Ms. Donna Shelley, who is down here, comes down here every year acting as the mama duck for a group of exchange students. And I'm honored to introduce them here right now. Would you stand up as I introduce you? I will not bother with last names, since I doubt you'll see any of them ever again. First is Nadia from Russia. And then there's Sarah from Lebanon. And there is Faruza from Azerbaijan. Please make them welcome. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. They are up in Sheridan as exchange students. I believe Nadia's at Sheridan High School. Sarah's at Sheridan. And you're at Bighorn, which is right by where I live. And so thank you and welcome. Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with a favorable recommendation on Senate File 85. There is a standing committee amendment, and I would ask that it be read in now, please.
Senate File 85, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, page 3, line 16.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, for a further explanation of both the bill and the standing committee amendment, I would ask that you call on Not a Slave to Fashion, Senator Hicks.
How are you going to answer that, Senator?
Mr. Chairman, there are some things that you just don't deserve an answer. Mr. Chairman, member of the committees, has the bill been moved? The bill has been moved. I bring to you a good little bill here that should require absolutely no piling on whatsoever. I would like to bring your attention. It was distributed earlier today. There's a sheet on top of your desk that says Senate File 85 and talks about the resident preference point. Let me preface this with saying there's absolutely no perfect system that exists when it comes to allocating licenses. But this is probably as good as it's going to get. And let me walk you through this sheet. The preference point system for moose and sheep has been in place for almost 18 years here in the state of Wyoming. The vast majority of the people like the system. 2007, the non-residents gained the right to gain preference points. Majority of the non-residents like the preference point system, and I'll tell you why, because Washington, Oregon, Nevada, Colorado, Montana, Utah, Kansas, Arizona, and California. Almost every western state in the United States has some type of point system. So this is not an anomaly. So if you're from another state, this is why the non-residents understand this is a pretty good system, because it works. It's all about equity. Okay, in 2008, the Wyoming Game and Fish Department conducted a survey, and in that survey in 2008, 54% of the residents indicated that they preferred a preference point system for elk, deer, and antelope. There was 46% of the population that were opposed at that time. Preference point, darling, here's one of the things that needs to understand. This is a voluntary system. You are not mandated, if you want to hunt elk, deer, and antelope in the state of Wyoming, you're not mandated to participate in the system. It has no bearing on general license hunting whatsoever. You can go buy a general license every year and never have to contribute a dime and not precluded from being able to hunt. There's vastly a large number of antelope permits left over every year that the residents have first choice to be able. So it doesn't preclude anybody from drawing an elk, deer, or antelope permit. You can go hunt every year. It's a voluntary point system. The point system rewards those who purchase a point. We'll talk about the amendment here in a minute. Under that point system, 75% of just those limited quota licenses will go to the point system. 25% of those licenses will still remain in the random draw. So even if you're a first-time applicant for a limited quota area, You still have an opportunity under this system to be able to draw a permit under that system. With that, one of the things, it's not a disadvantage to youth to participate in this program. What basically the preference point system does is if a youth wants to participate, it guarantees them sometime in their life they're going to draw one of these most coveted permits, and sometimes multiple permits if you go through that system. Here's what the random draw does for the youth of the state of Wyoming. It encourages you to gamble. Only thing the random draw does is give you an opportunity to apply for a license every year. It doesn't any way or any fashion give you the opportunity to hunt. That's one big difference in the system. One, with the youth, you're telling them that this is a 10% chance to draw. The probability is it's going to take them a long, long time to draw. The other system, under the preference point, you're guaranteed those youth are going to have an opportunity to draw. Maybe not the first year or the second year, but eventually they'll draw one of these permits. And here's something that's important, and I think it's the point system ensures that long-term Wyoming residents draw and have access to these tags. And I had a conversation with the good senator from Natrona County this morning, and he talked about his dad applying for 30 years for a bighorn sheep permit. And under the random system, never drew. In fact, if you go back to 1995 when moose and sheep permits first came in, that was part of the impetus that people had lived here their entire life and applied for 25 or 30 years and never draw one of these permits because it was just a random draw. If we'd have had that preference point system back then, eventually everybody will draw one of these permits. So that's something to take into consideration. I went through and did a statistical look. On average, if you take all the limited quota elk licenses in the state away, on average, you're guaranteed a license about every 3 to 4 years. Now, that's an average. The range is a little broader than that. If we go down and look at the limited quota deer licenses, about every 3 to 6 years, you're going to draw one of those really good deer licenses. Again, that's an average. It's not the range. On antelope licenses, almost every 2 to 3 years, you're guaranteed. Again, getting back to the parity issue, the point system provides certainty to people that want to hunt. One of the things that was interesting about the survey that was conducted, and it was an extensive survey, and one of the things that talked about in there is a majority of the applicants, the resident applicants, when you apply for one of these limited quota permits, and you apply and you apply and you apply and you never draw, you just quit. And it has the same effect on a youth. So you give a kid a chance to apply and apply and apply when he's 12 and 13 and 14 and 15 and 16, and pretty soon they just quit. So it provides certainty, and that's the one major benefactor of this system, is it provides certainty. With that, members, I refute you to the bill. Simple bill, if you just go through this, only thing this basically does is it just says everywhere, because we have an existing system already for non-residents, it just inserts the word residents. So now that we'd have a preference point system for both residents and non-residents. There is a standing committee amendment. I'd like to move that.
Senator Hicks, please move it. Yes.
The amendment is, and I'll talk to the amendment. We go to page 3, if I can find it. Page 3, line 16, only thing the standing committee does is it gives the commission the authority to go up to $20 a point instead of $10 a point. And there, gives them the flexibility if they want to charge 5 or 10 or various different denominations for each one of the species, they could do that. So it just changes that from $10 to $20. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'd ask for favorable consideration on the amendment.
Is there discussion on the amendment? Senator Nutting.
Mr. Chairman, could I just ask the sponsor to give an explanation of the fiscal note?
Senator Hicks.
Mr. Chairman, good senator from Cheyenne here. Basically, what the fiscal note is if we go into this system and the Game and Fish charges it, under this scenario you have here, was $10 a point. If you go through there and read that, it would generate, based on the testimony we got from the Game and Fish Department, on a conservative estimate, about $220,000 a year once this system goes in. If you raise that to $20 and you made that same assumption, it would effectively double that amount of revenue coming into the department. They said it'll cost them about $20,000 just to include residents into the current system right now. So it does generate approximately, if the commission chose to go up to $20 a point based on the same assumptions, it would double that $220,000 figure. Based on the testimony that they give in here, they said these figures are fairly conservative also. Mr. Chairman, I hope that answers the question.
Further discussion on the amendment? Question having been called on, all those in favor of Senator Hicks' motion to adopt the Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 85, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 85 is passed. We are back on the bill. Questions and discussions on the bill? Question having been called, all those in favor of Senator Burns' motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, that it do so with a favorable recommendation of Senate File 85, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Senate File 85 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next Senate file for our consideration is 96. The reading clerk will please read the bill.
Senate File 96, Compulsory School Attendance, sponsored by Senator Rothfuss, an act relating to compulsory school attendance. It was referred to Committee Number 4, Education. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. I, Senators Anderson, 02, Senators Cole, Landon, and Rothfuss, no. Senator Barnard, Senator Cole, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Senator Coe?
Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises and report, it do so with a do pass recommendation on Senate File 96, and to explain this non-controversial bill, I defer to Senator Rothfuss.
Senator Rothfuss.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I appreciate the introduction of the non-controversial bill. It is possible some of you may have received an email about this. Mr. Chairman, this bill has a relatively simple and straightforward objective. It's not a very long bill, which is always handy. We'll look at page 2, and we see basically the emphasis of the bill, which is to shift the compulsory education age in the state of Wyoming from either after your 16th birthday or completed the 10th grade to after your 18th birthday or completed the 12th grade. And those young adults are then responsible for remaining in school. Now, Mr. Chairman, it sounds very simple, but obviously there's a lot of concern, and there are concerns from a few areas. One of the areas is with regard to homeschooling and whether this would affect homeschooling, and that's the bulk of the concern and constituency that we've been hearing from. Another concern is whether or not this is taking away rights of the parents to make those decisions for their children. And, Mr. Chairman, in both cases, the answer is no, that this is not a concern from a homeschooling standpoint. In fact, it has very little effect on homeschooling other than the fact that homeschooling children would be required to attend theoretically until they were 18 as well. In other words, they couldn't drop out of homeschooling any more than they could drop out of high school of their own choice. Along the same lines is with regard to the choice of the parent, whether or not we're infringing upon a parent's rights. In fact, what this does is reinforce the parent's rights to choose what's best for their child, as opposed to the individual young adult's choice as somebody who's, say, 16 and a half years old to drop out of their own volition. Now, there's a big difference there. Who makes that choice that is the essential part of this bill? Currently, somebody who's just slightly over 16 years old or 17 years old has a right on their own, without their parents' consent, to drop out of high school. What this is saying is that the state of Wyoming Our public education system would like to see all of the children going through the school to graduate, or at least make it until they're 18, until they have their own choice, they're recognized as an adult, before they would be allowed to drop out without their parents' consent. And that's an essential point of this piece of legislation. It's not trying to remove a parent's choice. If a parent wants to allow their child to drop out earlier, this bill is not doing anything to prevent that. There's already language in statute which gives options and opportunities for parents to consult with the school district to allow for that, to provide the parent with the choice to choose what's best for their child. This is not trying to restrict or limit homeschooling. This is not trying to restrict the rights of parents. But we do recognize that there are those concerns. And in committee, we had a good, robust discussion about that, and we have some amendments coming up that try and address that even further to clarify and provide certainty that there's no intent here to limit homeschooling or to reduce parents' rights. I think this is a good time, Mr. Chairman, to get to the amendments. We have the First Amendment, the Committee of the Whole Amendment, and then following that, I'd go to my Second Amendment. But I think it's a great time to read in that First Amendment, if it's not already been read in, and introduce that one.
Senate File 96, Committee of the Whole Amendment, Number 1, page 1, line 7.
Senator Landon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Before I move this amendment, I would, by way of explanation, let the body know that what we were trying to do here was pretty well outlined by my colleague from Albany County. This is a particular concern for some of us, this parent piece. Mr. Chairman, this amendment, I think, does not do exactly what we would like for it to do. We think the next one will. So at this time, I'd like to withdraw this amendment. Thank you.
Your amendment has been withdrawn. The reading clerk will please read Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 2.
Senate File 96, Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 2. Delete the Landon et al. Committee of the Whole Amendment.
Senator Rothfuss.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I move Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 2 to Senate File 96 and ask the body for favorable consideration. Mr. Chairman, this amendment clarifies and really makes absolutely certain the parents' rights between ages 16 and 18 to allow or to sign out their kids from school without any possibility of exception. We already have language in little C, which is actually not provided, but it's in statute. Little C gives specific provisions allowing parents to effectively sign their kids out of school or provide evidence, and they have to go to the school district to get their children out of school before age 18. That's the statute right now. Between 16 and 18, obviously, the child has the right to drop out. There was no interest in revoking that right from the parent's standpoint, only from the young adult standpoint. So what this amendment does is provide absolute clarity along those lines. You can see that it says, for any child who is 16 years of age or more, the Board of Trustees of the school district shall exempt any child from the operation of this article upon written request from the parent, guardian, or other person after meeting in person with the school district counselor or administrator. What that's trying to do is make it absolutely clear that there won't be any exceptions. If a parent wants to go down and remove a 16 to 18 year old from school, whether that's a home school, whether that's a private school, or whether that's a public school, they will have every right to do so just based on their signature without any possibility of denial. Again, that was the original intent, that was the spirit of the bill. But we were asked to provide some additional clarification, and recognizing the fact that we did get a few emails on this topic, we thought it was worth going to a little bit greater length to clarify that intent to those folks that are concerned. The intent of this, Mr. Chairman, is really to raise the bar, raise that level of expectation for what we're looking for. We're looking for a maximum graduation rate. We're looking to try and get every kid to graduate. We're looking for young adults to stay in school until they're 18 and have that choice of their own, unless a parent feels it's a better choice otherwise. What we're effectively doing is keeping the parents on the hook. In our education committee, we're constantly looking for ways to engage the parents and to make sure that the parents are responsible in some way for the education of those children. And we have a difficult time doing that. This is one of the ways that we've discovered. We've had folks bring to our committee a desire to have this statutory age raised, and that's what this bill does. There's no intent to remove the parents' rights. In fact, what we're trying to do is ensure that the parents have those rights and are responsible for those children. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Oh, Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry.
Mr. President.
Amendment. Have you moved the amendment?
Mr. Chairman,
yes,
I did move the amendment, but we haven't yet. We're still on the amendment, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, we're on the amendment, and he did move it.
On the amendment, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. President, I've
Thank
already
you.
Called on you.
I have some question about the language, and perhaps it'll need some fixing on third reading or on second reading. But if you look at... C is not in the bill, but if you look at C, the person that can do this kind of thing is not only the parent or guardian, but it says other person having control or charge of any child. This amendment simply says or other person. I could probably go down and sign out Phil Nicholas's children out of school under this amendment, I think. So it might need some additional language there. I guess my question is, though, in this day and age, ultimately, on this amendment, and it may just go back to some, even currently right now, you have a parent has an opportunity to do this. When you have these so many split families where you have mom has custody or dad has custody or vice versa, all it takes is one. And sometimes I think you see, and I've seen it in my law practice, where they use that to game the child to come live with them, because if you don't, if you come live with me and you express your preference, which is part of our law, I'm not going to make you necessarily go to school. Now, granted, the court may determine that that's not in the best interest of the child, but I'm just wondering if language in this amendment should include both parents. I don't know. I'm just thought.
Huh? Senator Von Flader.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Standing on and for the amendment, but I do have a question. I just want to clarify that I'm maybe the only person reading line 14 in a manner that doesn't. I read it as it almost says the school board of trustees after meeting with the with the school district counselor. It's a little fuzzy to me because your object is the board of trustees, and they need the written request, and then after meeting in person with the school district counselor. Yeah, I just wonder. I'll just leave that there, and it may be part of an amendment for tomorrow if need be.
Senator Escobel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A couple of questions. I guess my first question is, I was just wondering if our majority floor leader's actions constituted a yes or a no. I wasn't quite sure what they meant. Sorry about that, Mr. Chairman. But I had the same question that Mr. President had in regard to or other person. The additional comments I would make would be that, as Mr. President mentioned, we have a lot of parents that are divorced, separated, what have you, and where they have joint custody. I was just wondering how the situation would be worked out where one parent says, yes, you can drop out, and the other parent says, no, he can't. Who's going to resolve that? Does it have to come to a court hearing? Or because I can imagine people that are in a separated situation will do whatever they can just to get at the other person. And I just would hate to see our school personnel get involved in some of these basically custody issues or these struggles between, which could be created by the child himself or herself. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Rothfuss.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I'll begin by saying good catch on the language. That would be a little bit awkward if you walked in and released Senator Nicholas's children from school. It's supposed to be mirrored language, Mr. Chairman, and clearly there were a couple of words left out. We'll definitely remedy that, and I appreciate the catch there. Regarding the two-parent situation, you know, with all of the difficulties in terms of the email and objections to this piece of legislation, I didn't expect to be in the middle of a divorce hearing as a as an additional concern. Mr. Chairman, the truth of the matter is I'm not entirely sure which would be the best way to do that, and I'd look to chat with the majority floor leader, or excuse me, Mr. President, on the best way to handle that if there is any better language. One parent typically should be sufficient. There certainly are going to be circumstances where that might be a contentious issue, and if we have any suggestions on better language that could remedy that or tighten that up, I'd appreciate seeing it and working with the rest of the body on coming up with suggestions there. Good Senator from Campbell County was curious about the agent of action here, where we're talking about the Board of Trustees, although the individual is going to be meeting in personally the school district counselor or administrator. The agent of action for this part of the statute, if you look at the full statute, is the board. The Board of Trustees of each school district may exempt is language from earlier up in A, which you can see in the original in the original bill itself. So the agent of action for this sub D amendment would again have to be the board that's taking the action to excuse or exempt the child. However, there's no requirement that they meet with the board. There's only a requirement under this that they provide that information after meeting in person with a school district counselor or administrator. So the language actually is in this situation as intended and consistent with statute. But if you have a preference, again, I'd be willing to work with you on that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If there aren't any more questions on a particular amendment, then I'd call for the question on the amendment, Mr. Chairman.
Hearing the question called, all those in favor of Senator Rothfuss's motion to adopt Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 2 to Senate File 96, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 2 to Senate File 96 has passed. We are back on the bill. Senator Landon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just real quickly, because I think we've covered this bill well, I commend the sponsor. I particularly want to commend the sponsor for his spirit of cooperation on an issue that was pretty important to me. You'll notice that I'm the only member of the Education Committee that did not sign on to this bill, and part of my heartburn was simply this entire parent piece. And I think we've worked very hard to try to get at that. You can see that we're not quite there yet. I want to make sure that we hammer home the point that we want parents involved. It's going to take them to come and get their student out of school. And I've come around to this bill, and I think it's okay. I think it's time. If we really want accountability in education, and we want this education system to improve, and I think it's okay for us to have this little cultural shift to where we tell our young people, you know, we expect you to go to school until you're 18 years old. We want you in school. Now, if mom and dad decide that that's not where you're supposed to be, it's easy. They go to the Board of Trustees, they check you out of school, and you do something else. But I commend the sponsor. I think it's a good bill. Thanks.
Senator Coe.
Mr. Chairman, in all the different things we've looked at, education accountability and school finance over the years, and We've constantly looked at one thing we'd really like to do, and that's to increase graduation rates. Now, there's a number of other states that have done something just like this. And I can tell you they have had remarkably good results from bills like this. And as we go down the road of education accountability, you know, that's one of our goals, to make kids career ready, college ready, and to have a much higher graduation rate. We've got a couple of, actually the two biggest districts in the state, in the 76-77% range. So I think this is a good step in the right direction as we look at what we're trying to do for our young people. Kids belong in school if they're going to have a chance at it. You might have some kid who might be a thug when he's 16, and all of a sudden he turns 17 and he sees the light, and away we go. So I don't know what light that would be, but anyway, I think this is a good bill. I think it's, we've had a lot of emails on it. I don't think the people necessarily understood the opting out provision that is provided in there with the parents. So I ask that you support the bill.
Senator Schiffer.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. And I'm not quite as excited about this bill as some others. First of all, I would respectfully request that we see that information from all the states that have a higher compulsory age and what their dropout rate is and how they compute the dropout rate. I think you'll be a little shocked at what you see if you take the other 50 states, and let's throw in Puerto Rico, too, because their graduation, they can't drop out until they're 18. But if you'd show us those, I'd appreciate it. Mr. Chairman, I'm a little concerned with this bill because what are the consequences going to be? Here's what happens. Say you're 17 years old and you're living on the wilder side of life and enjoying every minute of it, and you decide you're not going to go to school. And let's suppose, and I'm going to quote to you from an actual person who is now living in a place courtesy of the state. She was living not with her parents, not with either parent, not with grandma, but with an uncle and his second wife. And quite frankly, neither one of them cared too much what she did. She decided she was going to quit school. The uncle and his wife said, okay, and that's it. They absolutely do not care. That those are the families that get in trouble. And this law won't make any difference to them at all. Absolutely none. And what happens? They report it. That's the other person, is the uncle. And, of course, doesn't they? It's a misdemeanor. And they get fined $25 or 10 days in jail. Because they're providing this girl with a place to stay, because there's no other place. None. Okay, and she says, well, I'm 17, I'm not going back to school. Then she becomes an habitual truant. And that means that the state picks her up as a ward of the state. That's what happens. Are you really going to keep kids in school with this law? There isn't a single girl at the girls' school that's read this law. I guarantee you that. It isn't going to deter kids from going and living the way they're going to live. And there are better alternatives than this. We've got things like alternative schools, which we fund. And we do a pretty darn good job of funding them. And that entices kids who are at risk, who would normally drop out, to keep them in school, to make them want to learn. And yet, we're not doing it. So we've got to go even further. We've got to make sure we've got counselors and all those other supports. Because I assure you that those kids that want to drop out are going to drop out. It's the name of the game, folks. And this bill won't make a doggone bit of difference to those kids. They'll thumb their nose at both parents, each parent individually, grandma, grandpa, and they'll find a place to hang out. And they're not going to read this statute. When we start talking about excellence in school, what we ought to be talking about is not providing a hammer like this so that the child is going to end up a ward of the state if it goes through all the
machinations that it's likely to go through. If we want to talk quality of education, let's demand of our 23 school superintendents, you show us an excellent program that can keep kids in school. That's why they get paid, and you all saw the list of what those guys get paid. It's almost as much as the football coach, but not quite, but the football, or never mind, I won't go there. But those guys get paid a lot, and they're supposed to be professionals. And every one of them says, my district's the best in the state. And yet this is what happened. We got to go pass a law just to keep kids, the kids that have got an opportunity and an education, and those superintendents can't design a program that keeps them in, that keeps them involved. When this bill came up, I suggested to the sponsor, go visit your alternative school. See how they're doing. That's where these kids end up, is in those kind of programs. Go talk to not the superintendent. Go talk to the principals that got to deal with these kids. And you think that's what accountability is all about. It's not us passing a law that's going to hammer kids and whoever happens to be giving them shelter and throw granny in the jail and fine her $25 and she's probably on welfare. Boy, that makes a lot of sense. And then when you get all the way at the end of it, the state goes and grabs this kid, and they end up somewhere in the state's custody. And that's the outcome. That's what the penalties are. Keep reading this law. Read right on down. When you become an habitual truant, you go into state custody. We haven't accomplished a thing with it. I urge you to look very cautiously at this law. This is not going to get done what you want. Instead, let's talk about accountability, about programs, and those things that are constructive, rather than throwing them in jail and whopping granny with a $25 fine for crying out loud.
Senator Hicks.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I commend the sponsors of this bill for their intent. I think that's we all want to see that happen, to retain these kids in the school. But here's my concern is you've all been there. What happens if we do this and you force this child into a situation that he doesn't like? Now, put yourself in a classroom with the one kid that doesn't want to be there, that's going to be disruptive, distractive. What's that do to the rest of the kids in that classroom? My concern is you put somebody in an environment that they do not want to be in. The consequences of that is you're stealing from those other kids that do want to be there, that don't want to have this guy cracking joke and making faces and doing whatever they do behind the back of the teacher, and the teacher is always trying to address this issue of this discipline with this student. So while I have a great deal of empathy for the intent, I'm really concerned with the consequences. And I think the consequences in a case like this are probably more deleterious to the overall number of kids in that system than it is beneficial.
Senator Rothfuss.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. All good comments, and I appreciate the debate on this bill. Looking back at the good senator from Casey's comments, this bill does not solve all the problems. There was no intimation that it did. I certainly wish I had a piece of legislation before you that would solve the high school graduation difficulties that we have and make sure that everybody graduates and does everything they're supposed to. That would be an excellent piece of legislation. Regrettably, that piece of legislation doesn't exist. I like the ideas that were proposed by the good senator from Casey, making sure that we do a good job with alternative schools, making sure that superintendents come up with better programs, and I'd look forward to seeing legislation that said that. That would be something that the Education Committee would welcome, and that's a good way to facilitate increasing these graduation rates. But each of those ideas would fail to address every situation, and somewhere some grandmother would be fined $25 as a result of those policies probably too. It's difficult to extrapolate absolute failure for all from simply raising a standard, raising the bar. What we're doing in this legislation, or attempting to do with this legislation, is set a standard that we hope to achieve. The truancy laws are not vicious. It is true that habitual truants do end up getting dealt with by our Family Services Department. But what I heard was basically an indictment of our Family Services process, where that's considered to be a failure in not helping the children or helping these young adults. If we have a situation where the needs of those young adults are not being met by guardians who are not doing their job, are not being responsible guardians, that is something that we want to identify. That is something where we want to point to those children and say, look, these children need additional help, and this is another way to do that. I don't see that as a liability. I see that as an asset. Now, my good friend from Carbon County brought up another excellent point, and this is one that we've heard a lot about in the email, which is, what about the disruptive child who would rather be out of school? It definitely is an easy solution, Mr. Chairman, to say, all right, well, if these are kids that are disruptive, let's just let them drop out. That's best for everyone. It's certainly the easy solution. You know, as a public education system, we can say, if they're a bit of a challenge, why don't we even encourage them to drop out? Let's get rid of them because the rest of the kids will have an easier time. Regrettably, we have a different obligation as a public education system. We have to teach all the kids. We have to make sure they all get a chance. We have to address those disciplinary problems and try to solve them and still teach those kids through things like alternative schools or other programs. It's not our obligation or our duty or even our right to let those kids just drop out and cheer for that as a remedy for discipline. We're looking to the long-term future of all of our people. We owe it to them to try and address those problems head on. And I don't want to give that tool to our school districts or continue it. I would rather see the age of 18 as a standard. Now, this proposal has been brought time and again by school boards, by school districts, the Wyoming State School Board Association, and they're all in support of it. The reason they're in support of it is because they want to set a culture. They want to set an ethic. They want to set a standard. They want to say that we have an expectation as a state in our public school system that children graduate from high school. We don't want to be just leaving the choice to the parents, or excuse me, to the children. We want to be having that choice with the parents. It's an essential point. This raises that age to 18 to ensure that it's not some frivolous dropout. Now, I understand that there are going to be difficult cases and that this isn't going to solve everything. But it's a step in the right direction. The education community supports it, and I hope you'll support it as well.
Further discussion. Question having been called. Thank you. All those in favor of Senator Coe's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, that it do so with a recommendation, a favorable recommendation of Senate File 96, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
The ayes have it. Mr. Majority Floor Leader. Whoops. Okay, Senate File 96 has passed Committee of the Whole. Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Mr. Chairman, I move to revise the report.
You've heard the motion. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
I'm not going to allow a no vote. Well, I survived another year.
Is on.
You can have your chair.
Which glass is yours?
The one closest.
All right.
The reading clerk will read the Committee of the Whole report.
Mr. President, your Committee of the Whole, having had under consideration bills on general file, begs leave to report as follows. Senate File 9, do pass, amended. Senate File 68, do pass. Senate File 47, do pass amended. Senate File 66, do pass amended. Senate File 34, do pass amended. Senate File 62, do pass. Senate File 82, do pass. Senate File 84, do pass amended. Senate File 85, do pass amended. And Senate File 96, do pass amended. Senator Johnson, Chairman.
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. President, I move for the adoption of the Committee of the Whole report.
You've heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion is carried, and the report has been adopted. We have a standing committee report.
January the 17th, 2013, Mr. President, your committee number 7, Corporation Election and Political Subdivision, to whom was referred Senate File 37, Office of Consumer Advocate Revisions 2, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Case, Hines, Nutting, and Scott. No, Senator Johnson. Senator Hines, Chairman.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader, that clears the desk.
Mr. President, I move that the Senate stand adjourned until 10 a.m. Friday, tomorrow, on January 18th.
Announcement, Senator Geis.
Mr. President, your committee number 5, Agriculture, Public Land, and Water Resources, will meet in about 10 minutes. In S-15, we'll take up Senate File 75, Honor Farm Horse Program, Senate File 89, Veterinary Techs, Senate File 90, Administrative Control of Acquired Institutional Lands.
Senator Scott.
Mr. President, your committee number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, will meet tomorrow morning at 8 a.m. in our normal committee room. Senate File 79, Public Health Nursing, Senate File 72, Medicaid Benefit Recovery, and by way of future notice, we can get through those two in good shape. On Monday, we're going to do Senate File 48, Medicaid Assistance Hospice Care, and Senate File 97, Eligibility for Medicaid.
Further announcements, Senator Landon.
Thank you, Mr. President. Just a reminder, and maybe the Majority Floor Leader was going to do this, a reminder that the topic is health insurance exchanges. Some presenters will be upstairs, room 302, upon adjournment, Mr. President, to talk about this whole topic of health insurance exchange. So if you have any interest on that front, room 302. Thank you.
Further announcements, Senator Hines.
Mr. President, try to get it right this evening. The Joint Mineral Committee will meet tomorrow morning in room 302 at 8 a.m. for the report on the Governor's Energy Engineering STEM Integration Task Force report. This is the one that has been working. I think you all have this book, and everyone is invited. Also, Mr. President, your committee number 9 will meet tomorrow, Friday, January 18th, 15 minutes after noon recess, to address Senate File 119, Natural Gas Service Development.
Other announcements. You've heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Senate shall stand adjourned until 10 a.m. Friday, January 18th.